My name is Harshida, and I would like to hear from Gary and Linda what reverence means.
Since you cooked for all of us, you're allowed to cheat.
Maybe the way you cook the meal is reverent. So it's possible to cook a meal without reverence, and it's possible to cook a meal reverently. What's the difference? Do you remember, I asked you if you remembered what I said when I began to speak or read, as you work toward becoming reverent, as you use your own will and volition toward becoming reverent, as you become aware enough to distinguish between what is reverent and what is not, then everything else that I read follows. So how can you work toward being reverent? And why is it that we can now look so deeply and personally into reverence? Whereas maybe just 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, when people talked about the word reverent, they'd talk about what somebody told them reverence was. So for me, reverence is relating to the essence of a person or a thing, not to the appearance, not to the shell. And what Linda and I share is that, and many other people, is that human consciousness is shifting in a big way. Understatement. Unprecedented way. It's expanding our ability to experience beyond the limitations of the five senses. So, from the point of view of the five senses, I am a male, grandfather, white, educated, American, on and on and on. These are all characteristics that are temporary and part of my personality. But as we become multisensory, we begin to look at a personality, which means a body, mind, physical body, more like a suit, an earth suit. And as we do, we become more interested in what is wearing the suit than the suit. So if a friend of yours, say, comes down the stairs and she's wearing a dress you don't like, do you stop liking your friend? No, it's just something she's wearing. Well, it's much more complex than that when it comes to a personality, because there's meaning and purpose and power and what your personality is and the configuration of it and what it was born into and what it contributes. But the short of it is that your personality is an instrument for your soul. It's an energy tool that your soul adapts when it incarnated, which means when you were born, and when it returns home, which means when your personality returns to ashes and dust. So, if you're only relating personality to personality, then you're always thinking, well, you know, he's better looking than I am, better athlete, but I've got more money than he does. But, and it goes on and on, because every person is unique. So like the snowflake. So there's always going to be someone who's got more or less, is better or worse, more accomplished, less accomplished. But when you relate soul to soul, that's the only equality that really exists. And that's reverence. To me.
Well, I feel exactly the same way. And it actually has changed my life because when I saw people and myself as just a personality, I had lots of judgments about my own personality, about who I am, feeling inferior sometimes and superior other times. But I didn't see myself as a soul. I didn't see who I was, and I didn't see the people outside of me in that way either. And when I began to do that, everything changed. Because I could see that it didn't matter what they looked like. It didn't even matter what they said, really. It only mattered that I was connecting with them soul to soul, heart to heart. So that's, it's my process to get there. In fact, it's an everyday process for me. Because if I have any judgments of myself or anyone else, it's a process where I'm really always watching, looking, feeling, especially feeling. Because, and when I say feeling, I mean noticing if I have emotions that come up that are not loving. Like feeling angry or impatient or jealous or inferior. So when I feel that, and I notice where it is in my body, I mean actually feel it as a physical sensation. And I know that it's not coming from a loving part of me, because loving parts of me, all of them, feel reverence and connect soul to soul, everyone. But the parts of me that are inferior, that feel inferior, superior, jealous, angry, whatever it is that is coming up in the moment, stop me from feeling reverence. Stop me from being able to see you as a soul and me as a soul. And I'm always so grateful that I've become more and more aware so that I can have the sense of reverence and compassion and have the courage not to let the parts of me that would keep me distant from you get in my way, stop me from knowing how awesome you are, how awesome I am. So that's a little bit about reverence from me.
So that's how you work at being reverent. If you're angry, you left reverence behind. If you're jealous, superior and entitled, inferior and needing to please, vengeful, reverence is out the window. If you're obsessed with thoughts, you know, I can't live without her, I gotta have him, I need the new job, whatever the thought is that won't go away, there's no room for reverence in your life. The experience of it when that's happening. If you're compulsive, if you have to have your desk just right before you can really start to work, if you need to avoid the cracks in the sidewalk, you can't be reverent. If you have parts of your personality that are out of your control, need food, sex, pornography, drugs, tobacco, gambling, alcohol,
shopping.
You're not reverent. So that means whenever you're experiencing fear, because all of those are frightened parts of your personality, they originate in fear, they don't feel good, and they create destructive consequences when you follow them. You're not you're not in the energy of reverence. But when you're experiencing a loving part of your personality, which you experience as gratitude, or another one's appreciation, or another one's caring, patience, awe, now there's an ease. There there's a connection. Because whatever you're grateful for, you're interested in. Really interested in it. Whatever you appreciate, the same thing. You not appreciate for what it can do for you or what you can get from it, but because there it is. A miracle right in front of me. These are all experiences or lead you to the experience of reverence. Soul to soul connection. But you have to be able to distinguish between what's fear in you and what's love in you, and set the intention to act on what is love instead of what is fear, even while fear is inside of you and it hurts, like jealousy hurts, really hurts. So does anger, so do all the faces of fear. And they all preclude the experience of reverence. I spent most of my life with zero idea, much less experience of reverence. I was in the army. I was a paratrooper. I was in Vietnam. Not reverent things to do. Now, reverent doesn't mean being mushy, being soft, being a doormat to the world. Doesn't mean always smiling, bowing. There's a million ways to be reverent. Now, here's something. Krishna told Arjuna before the commencement of the greatest battle in the world. He had to talk to Arjuna because Arjuna was chickening out. He couldn't. He said, wait, I can't do this. To his chariot driver, he said, my knees won't carry me. My stomach is churning. These are my uncles. And Krishna says, can you fight without anger? Can you fight without judgment? Can you fight without all of those things? Because that is what the moment requires. Could that possibly be reverence? If you do anything except in response to the requirements of the moment, and you do it with an empowered heart without attachment to the outcome. Then you are fully engaged in what you are doing. And your full engagement is not to acquire something for yourself, a self-image, something that will make you feel better or more valuable. More better. Even better than that. When you relate soul to soul, there's power there. So I'm saying this so that you won't leave thinking that reverence has anything to do with sentimentality. It has to do with recognizing the immensity, the power of the moment that you're living in, and everyone that's in it. And then you see everyone that's in it in a way that far leaves behind any judgment like friend, adversary, honest, dishonest, villain, victim. That's long gone. As you're relating soul to soul, that's what is, and then you cannot harm life. So, well, wait a minute, then why did Krishna tell that to Arjuna? Well, remember, I started by saying we're becoming multisensory, which means we can make a distinction between our body and our mind and an immortal aspect of ourselves. You can't kill that. message. Well, actually, the same talk, Krishna says something very interesting. He says, he who thinks he can kill and he who thinks he can be killed are both wrong. I'm not saying kill anybody, because you can't kill a soul. Isn't it also somewhere in the Hindu scriptures? What is a soul? Instead of saying what it is, there's a list of what you can't do to it. Swords can't cut it. Fire can't burn it. When you relate to that, there's reverence. Can't be anything else. But what you might not get from just reading is that there is a component of reverence, or it's infused with reverence, is an experience that the best way to call it would be love. But be aware, it doesn't have to do with heart-shaped boxes and chocolate candy or Valentine's. It's a love that, I say personally, lifts me up, makes me engaged in the moment, makes me so... It's good.
We could take some questions. We have about 15 minutes. But I wanted to read. I forgot to introduce Gary. My mom actually bought her first book on Amazon, Seed of the Soul. And she was telling me some tidbits, and I was like, oh, that's great. And this was very interesting, the opening of the foreword to the book by Oprah. It says, I'll just read you a couple paragraphs here. I first read Seed of the Soul in 1989. As with all books I'm excited about, I bought copies for my friends and colleagues. And I happened to be the first one to finish, which meant I had no one to discuss the book with. So I got my hands on the Mount Shasta, California phone directory and called Gary Zukav because he was living there. Mr. Zukav, hello, my name is Oprah. I just wanted to talk to you about your book and would love for you to come to my show and share your... what did you say your name was? Oprah. Can you spell that, please? I did. O-P-R-A-H. And the H is silent, I explained. And then I told him I had a talk show, and I had to explain to him what a talk show was. Because Gary had been without a TV for several years. And this, of course, made me even more eager to speak with him, and I wanted to know how he knew what he knew. And it goes on. So Gary actually was a recluse, I don't know, a kind of a monk of sorts. Not a monk, but...
Secular monk. That's how I looked at myself.
And this kind of thing happened to him. And as you go a little forward, there's a bit by Maya Angelou, preface to The Seed of the Soul by Maya Angelou. And here's two sentences from her, and she speaks ravingly about how this book has influenced her. She says, I keep my second copy of the book covered in plastic at the kitchen table so that it will be protected from years of use and so that olive oil from a just-made salad will not smudge the cover. And of course, that's Maya Angelou talking about it. Flip forward a few more pages, and here's Gary himself in one paragraph. He says, while writing my first book, The Dancing Woolly Masters, which is sort of a bridge between science and spirituality, one of the first of its kind, I discovered to my complete surprise that inspiration that came from beyond my mind, non-physical intelligences that I could not articulate, and the electricity of creating consciously with constructive intent. I had never experienced anything like this. I loved these experiences, but for the most part, I forgot about them after the book was finished. And he goes on to describe some of his experiences of where this came from. very interesting person in so many ways. Someone who's, you know, he was just telling me how he was with Oprah's event like 2 days ago, and he got a seat in the side hallways, and all these people knew him. But the way they carry themselves, both Linda and Gary, is very humble. It's like, yeah, we were just, you know, in a cabin. I was in a cabin meditating, and then this woman named Oprah calls me, and then this kind of thing happens. But I'm still just trying to connect to that consciousness. And so I think that's the spirit that they bring to the world. So if you have any questions for them, we probably have time for a couple of them. You're welcome to ask them. I'd imagine a bunch of people have read some of his books. So you're welcome to share anything you'd like. Can we take the, maybe you just want to yell it out? We do have the live streaming, so maybe you just yell it out, I'll repeat it. Or if it's nearby, yeah.
So, Gary, when you say that we're at, in the midst of an unprecedented shift in human consciousness, I'm curious, how do you know that?
Aren't you in the midst of an unprecedented shift in consciousness? I know it that way too. I can also see it around me. You know, some people might say, "All right, what planet do you live on? Everything around us is collapsing. Every one of our social structures. I see more greed. I see more violence in the world." What we are seeing is the terminal dissolution of everything that is built on the perception of power as the ability to manipulate and to control. So the book that I'm writing now is, I hope, the my intention in writing it is to show people like us that this dysfunction is not the product of a pathology, but of a profoundly positive process. All of our social structures are built on the perception of power as external, the ability to manipulate and to control, and that's why every one of them is becoming dysfunctional on the way to dissolution. They don't have salvage value. They can't be fixed because they're not broken. They were built by a five-sensory species for five-sensory humans who are evolving by pursuing external power. Now external power has become toxic. What used to be good medicine is poison. So how can anything that expresses external power have a future? So, the good news is that all of these social structures are beginning to be replaced, and new social structures are growing up like grass growing through cracks in the sidewalk. And there are just myriad examples. There are some places, for example, some collectives in which there is no trace of the energy of the soul. For example, international relations, multinational corporations. There's not a flicker of compassion or a trace of wisdom in them. But while they are massively, because they are massively moving forward as usual, at the same time, there are millions of individuals who are creating businesses. And this is the place where business as exploitation is meeting explorers of the heart. And there's no maps for this. A combination of commerce and spiritual partnership is occurring in these millions of enterprises. And these millions of enterprises are changing the intention of business from an endeavor that provides goods and services in order to generate profit to a dynamic that creates profit in order to provide goods and services. Did you follow that shift? It was a 180-degree shift from exploitation to contribution. There are literally countless examples of this. We're on the ground floor of an unprecedented transformation. We're pioneers. It doesn't make us any better because we see things a little sooner than others have or will. It just means we have the responsibility, like Billy Will, of acting on what we see. What do we do when we wake up as multisensory humans in a world of discord, competition, hoarding, a world in which life is a cheap commodity? That's what we all have to answer. Because the intentions of the soul are harmony, cooperation, sharing, and reverence for life. So being spiritual in a world that doesn't recognize spirit is quite something, isn't it? That's what brought us to Nippon and Guri. That's what brought us together. That's what brought all of us together tonight, because that's what we're all doing. We're waking up in a world that's brutal, that was created over millennia by five sensory individuals evolving by pursuing external power, and that doesn't make them wrong or bad. However, it is interesting to note that external power itself did not create all of the issues that we have, the destructive issues. It was the pursuit of external power without reverence that did that. But that's now in the past. We are beyond a threshold. We're in new territory. Emotions are important, central in fact. Intention is everything. And there's only two intentions, bedrock, bottom, love and fear. And in each action and each word, what's your intention? Learning to recognize that, and then choosing to use your will to express the loving part of your personality, a loving part. When a frightened part is active, creates real power in you in that moment. And when you do it again and again and again and again and more agains, that part of you begins to lose its control over you, and you gain power over it, and eventually it disintegrates, and the loving parts of your personality begin to fill more and more of your field of awareness.
So when you say a frightened part, you mean a lot of people will call it ego. So what you mean is specific parts of your personality, like jealousy or feeling overwhelmed, even angry, jealous, we're looking at them as specific parts of the personality that show up in your body in different ways and different thoughts, so that you can be really specific to see them, so you can actually notice them and not act on them when they come up.
So if ego means to you the frightened parts of your personality, we're talking about the same thing. But we use specifics, because now that we're multisensory, we can be specific. We can say, I can say when I'm angry, this is not I. This experience is not coming from the ground of my unchangeable ground of my being. It's coming from a part of my personality. Same thing in you. See for yourself. It seems like that's who you are when you're angry or feeling depressed or overwhelmed or anxious or resentful, but it's only a part of your personality. And there's other parts that would address whatever circumstance you're in very differently, with patience, appreciation, gratitude, love. And the frightened part of your personality will say, Are you losing a wire somewhere? How can I be grateful for cancer? How can I be grateful that my house has been foreclosed? How can I be grateful that my child is ill? When you begin to see that everything in the Earth School serves your spiritual development, and it may not be an experience experience that your personality would choose, but it is nonetheless an experience that is required to bring awareness of the power and nature of the soul into the consciousness of the personality, then you will be grateful. You will cry.
Yeah. I have a question back that we'll go with one here.
I want to return to the reading, and we talked a lot about reverence, and but a word that came up a lot was empowerment in the reading that I didn't hear addressed much in the circle or in your talk, and I really struggled with how does empowerment relate to reverence and to everything else you just talked about.
It's at the center of it. You can't reverent if you're not empowered. Now, empowerment doesn't mean that you have more ability to manipulate and to control, to impress, to get people to do what you want to do, to buy a Lamborghini, to have people say yes, sir, and for you to get whatever it is you want when your personality wants it. That's not what we're talking about when we say empowerment. That is what most people think of as power. The ability to change, to manipulate the outside world in order to make themselves feel valuable or safe. What we're talking about when we say empowerment is the alignment of your personality with your soul. The alignment of your personality with your soul. And that requires work. And that's why this excerpt that Nipun created happen to start with the words, as you work on becoming reverent. Because while you are in the control of a frightened part of your personality, and you're not aware of it, you're acting unconsciously. And when you are aware of it, and you choose to act from the frightened part anyway, then you're creating even more consequences because you are aware that acting on fear creates only violence and destruction. Now, I'm suggesting that you experiment with these things, not that you take anything that Linda or I say as so. We would never suggest that. In fact, we suggest that you not do that in any circumstance with anybody. That you always open yourself to what your experience is, because only you can choose what you will do next. Only you can choose the intention with which you will do it, and only you will then experience the consequences of what that intention creates. That's karma. Everybody here knows that. It's the universal law of cause and effect. The universal impersonal teacher of responsibility. And all of that, as you experience it in your life, leads you directly to reverence, which is awe of the universe. Not awe like you bow down and you say, I'm unworthy, I'm unworthy. Not like that at all. It's all like I'm looking at you right now. It's awe. It's awesome. It takes a lot of courage and clarity to face the power of your life in the present moment. And that means the power of the people that you are with. Sometimes they don't know how much power they have, but I'll suggest how much. I'll suggest that each of us is a powerful and creative, compassionate, and loving spirit. And the pain in your life is a measure of the distance between this reality and your self-image. And this creative and compassionate, powerful, and loving spirit that you are is reverent. it doesn't know another experience.
Yes, could you explain a little bit more in detail what you mean by multisensory?
I'll give you some examples of multisensory experiences. When you begin to sense that you are more than a mind and a body. When you begin to sense that your experiences and your world are more than random. That there's a meaning behind them. When you begin to experience that the universe is not inert, which means dead, cold, random, but that it is alive, wise, and compassionate, that's a multisensory experience. As you become multisensory, your intuition becomes more available to you. So you may be walking down the aisle in a grocery store and someone comes towards you and you know things about that person that your eyes and your ears and no one else has told you. You don't know how you know it. You say, that person can't be trusted. Or this is a good person. And sometimes you can be surprised at the specificity of what you can know about other people. Like, she's divorced and lonely. And looking for someone to solve all of that for her. These are multisensory perceptions, experiences of intuition, which means the voice of the non-physical world. As you become multisensory, you begin to look at birth and death very differently. We celebrate birth, but we don't celebrate death. Actually, Linda and I do. We're just celebrating the passing on of the mother of one of our advisors. But that is the end of a journey of a soul through the Earth School. A soul that incarnated voluntarily in order to learn wisdom, in order to become authentically powerful in the domain of physicalness. And as sentences like that resonate with you, that's multisensory perception.
Can you pass it back to Guri?
Thanks. Guri, can you share a little bit about your time as a secular monk? What brought you to that, and did you find what you were looking for?
Pain brought me to it, and specifically it was my sexual addiction, which I knew by then I had, and which I had, I wasn't acting on it, I'd gone beyond that. But I met a teacher I liked, liked as an understatement. He owed me. He was a Chan master. He's an old Chinese man. And he was celibate. I thought, I'll be celibate like him. I made a big mistake. I didn't realize that he was celibate because it supported him. I was celibate because I was terrified of my own sexuality. Big difference. That's about the time that Linda entered the picture. We were at an event together, and I was not attracted to Linda at all. I mean, her hair was cut like a bowl cut, you know, like monks in some part of the world, like our medieval monks had cut their hair. She was barefoot, believe that, and she was wearing a sweatsuit. She was walking on gravel and barefoot. I mean, she just looked like a... not all that attractive to me. But we got put together at this retreat several ways. One was that a friend of mine asked me to go find her because she's a chiropractor and was giving treatments and he needed one. Another was that a friend of mine saved me a seat at a concert in the evening, and a friend of Linda saved her a seat, and the two seats were together, those kind of things. And then one day she came up to me, and one thing I noticed about her right away is she hugs a lot. And her hugs are long. And this was a New Age retreat, so there was a lot of hugging. And of all the people I didn't want to get hugged by, was Linda was at the top of my list. And so she came up and gave me one of those hugs that I didn't want to get, real close, minute and a half, full body. And that was pretty exciting, if you know what I mean. It's pretty hard to hide that much excitement or that kind when someone's hugging you. And I did everything I could to make myself unexcited. And suddenly, wow, I had a pain at the very bottom of my torso in my coccyx area. That was like a nuclear explosion. Oh, it hurt. I hurt. I couldn't stand up. I couldn't sit down. I wasn't. And said goodbye and went her way. But I was feeling this, and it occurred to me later what had happened. I grew up in a small town in Kansas that had a highway, two lanes, going right through it. And about somewhere in junior high school for me, the state put a bypass around my town. So the highway came down and then curved around like that, like a half moon, and then went straight again. It wasn't good for the town because it diverted everybody around it. It wasn't good for the businesses. That's what I've been trying to do to my sexuality. And it didn't work. And I was hurting myself. And the word is symbolic, by the way. If you haven't noticed, you will if you start looking for it. So I thought about it. And then later on, when Linda and I were walking by a stream, I wanted to tell her about that. And so, that, I believe, looking back on it, was probably the end of my secular monk days. Now, Linda, I still didn't want to be that much associated with Linda. At the end of the event, all of my friends, because they were all from Mount Shasta, California, where I lived, I said, hey, Gary, we're going to go take a swim in the waterfall. You want to come? Why don't you bring Linda? I thought, oh, that really triggered me. Now, Linda, 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 what is this with Linda? Why do I have to do everything with Linda? And then she moved to Mount Shasta. And it wasn't because of me. It was because she'd already planned to do that. I think probably it was because she wasn't going to let anything having to do with a man or anyone else determine whether she was going to do what she planned to do. But she did. She moved to Mount Shasta and we started seeing each other. Sometimes I didn't want to see her. Sometimes I did. I mean, sometimes I really enjoyed our interactions and sometimes I was really uncomfortable. I just sit there being uncomfortable. But after a while, I realized I was looking forward to our times together. And then once she went to Europe and I was behind, and while she was gone, I realized I didn't want to live without her. It wasn't melodramatic. It just meant that she had her little cabin down the street and I had my little cabin, and I thought we should live in the same cabin. And then sex was not part of the picture. We both, by that time, didn't want to muddy the water. There was something else occurring, something brand new to me. Relationship to me with a woman used to start with sex, and then it was very confusing after that. And I didn't want that. I wanted to know what this other thing was. It turned out to be spiritual partnership. Partnership between equals for the purpose of spiritual growth. So we moved in together. and there was no sex for quite a while, because not because we were both sexual people, but because it wasn't appropriate for what we wanted to do. So that's why probably that hug that caused me so much pain in my second chakra area was the beginning of the end of my secular monk. It was a self-image that I sort of was proud of. I liked it. It protected me. But I had to come to terms with my sexuality, because I was in this community with a lot of sisters, and that kind of arousal could not send any message that I wanted to send. Some of them might think, oh, Gary is interested in relating in a new way. That's not the message I wanted to send them. I love them all. Or they might think, oh, Gary must relate in a new way, and I don't like it. And they would leave me, and I'd lose someone who is important to me. So I hope that answers your question about my secular monk days. It lasted about 7 years.
We'll have to conclude, but I have one last tidbit, since you mentioned a Chinese monk, wise monk. If you could share a lesson that you learned from him that still stays with you, and then any closing words before we do a moment of gratitude.
Can I shift to another monk?
Sure. Any monk is good.
Linda and I were in Mount Shasta when a Cambodian monk came, and he was 103, and people called him Bonte, which I think was a term of Cambodian term of endearment. And Bonte told us a story, a little gathering, smaller than this one, about when he was a young man walking through China, which for Bonte meant when he was in his 50s. And he met a priest on the road, and they walked together and walked together and walked together. And then after a while, the priest said, this is my village over here. Would you like to visit my village? And Bonte said, I would. So they went to the village, and then the priest said, this is my church. Would you like to visit my church? And Bonte said, I would. And when they got in the church, the priest said, will you take the Lord Jesus Christ as your Savior? And Bonte said, I will. And he did. Then Bonte asked the priest, will you take the Lord Buddha as your Savior? And the priest said, I will not. And Bonte said, then I have two Saviors, and you only have one.
Sure. So I was just thinking, when you were talking about multisensory, I wanted to say that the reason, there are many things that happened when Gary and I met, and one of them, well, a couple of things. First of all, I had read the Dancing Wuyi Masters in 1979 and The Seat of the Soul in 1989, because I saw Gary's name on it and I loved the Dancing Wuyi Masters. And I hadn't met Gary yet, but the book was so important to me. I just couldn't believe the words. I was reading words that I knew inside of me were true. And I'd never talked to anybody about these things, so it was really amazing. I didn't even know they were in me until I read it. And so when I met Gary a few years later at this retreat, I knew right away when I met him that I was being connected with him. I don't mean I had a sexual attraction to him, I don't mean like that. I mean, I really knew for some reason I was being connected in a deep way. So that was a really strong multisensory experience. But as soon as that happened, I had so much fear come up, because I felt so inferior to someone who had written these books that were so important to me. And I didn't even know how I could speak to him. you know, but I knew what was happening, you know, in one way, but then I had just so much fear, and I realized that this fear had really controlled my life. Any time that I felt inferior to someone, and I always felt inferior to men, but I didn't realize it until that happened, actually, that the ones I was interested in. And so a couple of multi-sensory things that happened during that time was I knew, and you can tell from Gary's telling the story, I knew he was really frightened to be in a relationship. When that came to me, I didn't know what was going on with him. I just knew he was speaking one night, and I kept getting this information about him, and I thought, oh, okay. How interesting, you know, different information than he was speaking about. And so it was quite an amazing thing to open myself in that way. And then I began to have more and more experiences like that. But I'd had many throughout my life. I just, when I read The Seat of the Soul, I realized that I had been having multi-sensory experiences from when I was really small, but I didn't see it that way. I didn't know that's what it was until I read the book, and I went, oh, this is really amazing. Not only am I having them, everyone has that opportunity if we don't shut it out. So I was really, really grateful. And it's so good to be here with all of you. I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful for my courage to change myself enough that I can see you and love you and be so grateful to be here. And I really worked hard on changing the part of me that felt inferior, that would have never been able to be up here talking to you, ever. And I kept saying, yes, I'll do whatever I need to do. And I'll speak in front of people even when I don't want to. I'll do retreats with Gary even though parts of me want to leave. I'll keep doing it, and I'll keep doing it, and I'll keep doing it until it loses its power. And that allows me to be able to feel, since our word is reverence to me, the reverence for all of you and for myself, and I'm really grateful to be here with you.
I am also, thank you, Nipun. Thank you, Gary, for inviting us, and thank you, Mr. Mehta and Mrs. Mehta, for allowing us into your home. And thank you, and allowing us to do something so remarkable. Food is holy. We're going to share food together. That's remarkable. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Earlier today, Linda was sharing how when she was in Mount Shasta, she had a vision of all these small groups of people all over the world coming together in their hands. Here, why don't you describe it? Instead of second hand, we could have first hand.
I had a vision of circles overlapping all over the world. I knew people were completely connected all over the world in small circles, but all of them interconnected. And it was just an amazing thing, and I've been doing everything I know how to do to have that come into being. And I know it's not about me, it's about all of us. All of us doing that, like this circle here and all the circles that are happening all over the globe, because we need each other. We need to really have relationships of substance and depth with each other. We call that spiritual partnership. It's not just about couples, it's about every relationship. And so that was my vision, and I'm really, so it's always amazing for me to see more and more circles, this one, and no matter how they look, it doesn't look like a circle, but I know it's a circle. So, yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for coming. This is actually a very, I had leaked it out to a few people, but it's kind of a random sub-selection, but how do you, you know, it's just so many people, I think some people are here for the first time, at least I don't recognize many of them, and it's just what the universe brought together on this particular day. So thank you all for co-creating this space, however it unfolded. And it's beautiful. And thank you, Gary and Linda, for just being who you are and for your lifelong work that has touched so many people. Certainly with Gary, it's very obvious. He's written these books and, you know, so many people have read them. But Linda, I wanted to especially say that how you hold yourself in spiritual partnership with the world is very touching and very beautiful. So thank you for coming and being here, and thank you all for holding that space. We'll do 2 minutes in gratitude. We're grateful to my dad over here and my mom. My mom, of course, cooking for everybody as she has done for the last 18 years. Every single Wednesday, like this, and not quite, we limited the number of RSVPs, yeah, really awesome to see their unconditional, speaking of doing things without any vested interest in the outcomes, you know, you just can't do this week in and week out for 18 years unless, if you have a vested hidden agenda, it would show up in year number 3, you know. So it's an honor to be on the receiving end of their generosity, and I know they feel grateful that we gave them a chance to be of service. So thank you all. We'll end with 2 minutes of silence, and then we'll explain what happens next.